The following message was given at Emmanuel Baptist Church, Coconut Creek, Florida.
All right, let's pray. Our Father, we are so thankful for your mercies to us that are new every morning and have been with us throughout the week. We thank you for Christ, by whom we have been reconciled to you. And we know that you are our Father and that if God is for us, who can be against us? We thank you for the opportunity that has been granted to us today to gather with your people once again, to worship you, to study your holy word together, to see one another, to encourage one another and exhort one another to love and good works. And we also pray that you would meet with us now in our Sunday school class and also with all of our classes, with our children, our young people. We continue to cry out to you for their souls and their salvation. And so help us now and that our study would not just be an academic thing, but we would learn wisdom for our own time and that we would also be strengthened in our trust and confidence in you. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so we're back to church history today, and through the summer, there'll be more church history classes than have been lately, and still be doing some of the other subjects as well, but hopefully we can get into a little bit of a routine here. Let me just review where we are. We're in the Reformation period of church history still. We're in section 9 of that study, which is progress, developments, and conflict that followed the initial stages of the Reformation. So we're into the next generation after the Reformation, the generation after that. And we began by looking at developments that occurred in Lutheranism, the development of Reformed Orthodoxy in Europe after Calvin, and then Unit 3, the Puritan era in England, which we've been in now for some time. And so we're going to pick up with that again. Now, it's a common boast among the English that Britain is an impenetrable island that's safe from foreign powers. And attention's often drawn to the fact that England has never been successfully invaded by a foreign power since the 11th century. I think it was, 1066 that William the Conqueror, the Norman invasion of England. And so it's sort of the general idea that's out there among people, and even among English people, I think that was the last time they were ever successfully invaded. But actually, that's not strictly true. It was certainly successfully invaded in the period of church history that we're about to consider this morning. It was invaded by the Dutch ruler William of Orange in 1688. And sometimes this is looked over. It's not counted as an invasion of England because his invasion actually had popular support from many of the English people, but it was an invasion nonetheless. He arrived on English soil accompanied by a Dutch army, and this has come down to us in history as what is called the Glorious Revolution, and it also marks the end of the Puritan era in England. So this will be, God willing, our last lesson on that particular era of church history in England. So I mentioned this as an introduction to where we've arrived in our study of church history. The Puritan era in England, we've been looking at that, also touched briefly on the contemporaries of the English Puritans, the Covenanters in Scotland. And the Puritan era lasted roughly from 1559 to 1689. So let me just very briefly remind us of what we have considered. You remember the Puritans, as they're called, were serious Reformed Christians in England who were strongly committed to the Bible, who believed in the centrality of preaching and the necessity of personal conversion and practical piety, and who advocated for a more thorough reformation of the English church and its worship to conform with the Scriptures. And that was over against the partial reformation that had been established by the Elizabethan settlement. And the Elizabethan settlement was the resulting state of affairs in England after Elizabeth took the throne in 1558. And this period, this conflict in England, the Puritan era, is a long one. It spanned the reign of several monarchs. You remember Before we get to that period, you have the Reformation, Henry VIII, and Edward, and then Bloody Mary, and then Elizabeth. And really, it's from Elizabeth's reign that we trace out what's called the Puritan era. And she reigned from 1558 to 1603, but then that also leads into James I, the Stuart dynasty that then takes the throne, Charles I. Then we have this civil war that occurred in England when Charles I was defeated by the parliamentary army, and we have the Commonwealth period then that followed when England was a republic. Then we have the reign of Charles II, and then James II, and then the Glorious Revolution. Well, we finished the Elizabethan period, the period under James I, the period under Charles I. We've considered the civil war that occurred near the end of Charles I's reign between the crown or loyalists and the English Parliament, which was largely dominated by Puritans. And the wars went badly for Charles, and eventually he was beheaded. And then began the Commonwealth period, in which England had no king. Oliver Cromwell, the brilliant general of the parliamentary army, served as Lord Protector of an English Republic. And this period in which England was a republic without a king was from 1649 to 1660. Cromwell died in 1658. He was succeeded as Lord Protector by his son, or we might call it Prime Minister, by his son Richard. Richard was not a kind of man. He was a good man, but he lacked the political skills and the following and the confidence that his father had and people had in his father, and the situation began to deteriorate under Richard's government, and eventually this led to what we considered last time, what is called the Restoration. And without going over, it's called the Restoration because of the restoration of the crown, the monarchy. Without going over all the details, what led to this, which we covered, eventually Charles II, who was the son of Charles I, who had been beheaded, was invited back from his exile in the Dutch Republic to reestablish the crown and to take the throne. And he arrived with popular rejoicing. Parliament was resolved. New elections occurred. The new election produced in May of 1661 what has been called the Cavalier Parliament. And remember, the word Cavalier was a name given to those who were supportive of the crown in the Civil War. Why was it called that? Because it was overwhelmingly Anglican royalist in its membership. And this parliament enacted a new religious settlement, the Clarendon Code. It was strongly Episcopalian in its nature, and it was very oppressive toward non-Episcopalians, which would be Congregationalists, Baptists, and Presbyterians. Quoting Needham, the Anglican royalist MPs were in no mood to be generous to the Presbyterians, Independents, and Baptists, who had humiliated them on the battlefield, killed their king, and outlawed their worship. Charles had no choice but to fall in with this vengeful mood. The whole country, indeed, seemed to be in an anti-Puritan state of mind, a strange amalgam of Episcopalian religious fervor and sheer licentious rejection of moral restraint. There was this huge shift in popular sentiment, and there were a number of reasons for that. There was weariness with all of this change and the incessant change that kept happening and all of this instability and uncertainty. And there was also really, in English people, there was kind of this long-standing kind of romantic tradition and love that was still there in the hearts of many people for the idea of England having a monarch and having a king. But in addition, there was a kind of pendulum swing with respect to morality and religion. The mood of the country was such immediately after the Restoration that Puritanism and the serious brand of Christianity that it represented was now the butt of jokes and ridicule. 600 minor alterations were made in the previously banned prayer book, all in a manner that was unfavorable to the Puritans. And in May of 1662, the Parliament passed the Act of Uniformity, and this act came into effect on St. Bartholomew's Day, the 24th of August, and you may remember that was the day of the massacre of Huguenot Protestants that occurred in France several years prior to this. So there was something symbolic really about that day, I think, being the day that the act came into effect. It required all parish clergy to submit unconditionally to the doctrine and worship of the restored Anglican Church, promise never to attempt any change to the status quo, and to receive episcopal ordination if they did not have it. Remember, the Anglican Church and Episcopalianism is the same thing. It's not two different things. All right, Anglicanism or Episcopalianism. So around 700 Puritan pastors had already been forced to leave the established church by previous enactments just before this, and 200 university lecturers had already been expelled for their Puritanism. And now with the Act of Uniformity being passed, an additional 1,000 Puritan-minded clergy left the established church rather than to conform. They became what we're going to be referring to as nonconformists. So in total, it was roughly 2,000 ministers who were ejected from their pulpits, and these included men like, you may have heard of, like Thomas Manton, John Owen, Thomas Goodwin, and many others. And there were other acts that were passed by Parliament, one that forbid dissenting ministers from traveling within 5 miles of an incorporated town, and they were forbidden to teach school. The Baptist pastor John Bunyan, most of us have heard of John Bunyan, he suffered 12 years in prison in the jail at Bedford, which is where he wrote Pilgrim's Progress. Well, in spite of these persecutions, many of the nonconformist pastors, they continued preaching, Independents, Presbyterians, Baptists, some tried to conceal their disobedience or to meet in kind of clandestine ways. They constructed houses. They met in houses sometimes that were constructed with these elaborate escape routes. And some of the great Puritans that many of us have read ministered under these difficult circumstances. For example, men like John Flavel and others. Well, in spite of seeking ingenious ways to try to obey the Clarendon Code without compromising or by disobeying it in a sneaky or undercover way, many nonconformist ministers were arrested and punished. Over 200 of the clergy were expelled from the National Church in 1660 to 1662 ended up in prison. And Needham tells us that in London alone, over 3,800 nonconformists were arrested and tried for illegal worship. And that has been estimated that a total number of between 5,000 and 8,000 nonconformists may have died in prison. Well, Charles II died in 1685. And on his deathbed, he came out of the closet, and what everyone had suspected about him was proven to be true. He was received into the Roman Catholic Church. And he had no legitimate children to succeed him, and therefore his Roman Catholic brother, James II, took the throne, and that's where we pick up. All the rest of this has been reviewed, and this is where we pick up with the reign of James II and then the Glorious Revolution. And I'm going to largely be following Nick Needham and his treatment of this period. I'm also indebted to a lesser degree, but to Williston Walker's A History of the Christian Church, and in a small degree to Dave Merrick's lectures on church history. Now, James II took the throne in 1685, and he was an earnest, devoted Roman Catholic. And he saw the establishment of Roman Catholicism in England, that was one of his chief goals when he took the throne. Now, there were two major political parties in England at this time, and this is important for us. If we're going to understand the dynamics of what's going to develop here, we need to understand there were two parties. There were the Tories. Okay, the Tories were James's allies, and the first article of their creed, as it were, was it's never right to resist a lawfully crowned king. The Whigs, this was the party that championed the rights of the nonconformists. And for the most part, they were not in favor of James II becoming king. So you have the Whigs, who tended to champion the causes and the rights of nonconformists, who were originally not in favor of James being put on the throne. But then you have the Tories, who were committed Anglicans, and they also had a high view of the prerogatives of the English crown, and they were supportive of James. But there was a problem. Most of the Tories were committed Anglicans. They were committed Anglicans, while James was a Roman Catholic. And this is where the problem is going to come in. In other words, James comes into a situation where he wants to promote Roman Catholicism, but it's the Tories who are supporting him coming to the crown because of their kind of very conservative view of the monarchy and also their Anglicanism, but they're not Roman Catholics. That doesn't mean they support Roman Catholicism. So he's got this dance he has to do to keep the Tories in his favor. And if at any time he loses their support, he's in trouble because the Whigs already don't support him, right? Well, he played his cards well at first. He never criticized the Church of England. He praised it for its support and loyalty to him. He allowed himself to be crowned according to the traditional Anglican ceremony. And he publicly promised to respect and maintain the Anglican Church. He also disavowed any intent to re-Catholicize England. And one of those political promises, right, that 90% of the time turned out to be lies, right? Nothing's ever changed, has it? So, this was the initial relationship between the monarch and the English church. If it ever broke down, he would be in trouble. But remember, James, again, was a Roman Catholic, and it was his secret intent to establish Roman Catholicism in England. And, you know, as we go through this, this is one king I look at, and I think this guy was, he was stupid. He really was. He turns the whole country against himself in a very short period of time. Within 3 years, his relationship with his Tory supporters was irreparably broken, and both Tories and Whigs joined together in opposing him. And how did this happen? Well, let's consider, first of all, the Monmouth Rebellion. James tried to reassure the country that he was no tyrant by holding a general election in the first year of his reign, 1685. The parliament that resulted was dominated by Tories who were loyal to the king. But there was also still opposition to the king in the most committed Protestant sections of the population. They didn't trust him. They didn't believe his attempts to present himself as moderate. And only a month after the parliament met, a violent popular rebellion broke out in the southwestern counties of England, and it was led by James Scott, Duke of Monmouth. Now, he was a Protestant and a Whig, and he had been the Whig's choice for the throne, not James. He was now living in exile in the Dutch Republic, but he gambled that the strongly nonconformist people of southwestern England would back his claim, would rise up against James if he would just show his face and urge them on. And there were many who did rally to support Monmouth when he landed at Lyme Regis in Dorset on June the 11th, but none of the Protestant nobility were willing to support what they saw as, and rightly so, a really foolhardy scheme. Monmouth's ragtag army was destroyed by the king's forces, and the aftermath of this was not good for nonconformists. But, as it turns out, it was not good for James either, because he overplayed his hand. James placed George Jeffreys in charge of the trials of those who had been taken prisoner after the uprising, and this man was extremely stern and very severe in his judgment. Some 320 people were executed by hanging. 800 to 900 were assigned to slave labor in the Caribbean islands. The bodies of the executed were put on display at various public spots as gruesome object lessons. And there were two trials that became kind of particularly famous and harmful to the popular impressions that people had of James. There was an elderly woman named Alice Lyle, a member of the royalist gentry, and she was tried for simply giving compassionate shelter to a nonconformist minister and his friend who had fled from the battlefield, and because of this, she was beheaded. And another lady, the Baptist Elizabeth Gaunt, was tried for attempting to help another refugee flee the country, and she was burnt alive. She was the last woman, by the way, to be punished by that method in English history, the Baptist Elizabeth Gaunt. Although most of the people in England did not support the Monmouth Rebellion, they were shocked and horrified at the government's brutality in the aftermath. And it was a failure in public relations for James. And soon his failures in public relations got worse. In October of 1685, Louis XIV, the Catholic King of France, revoked the Edict of Nantes. Does anybody remember what the Edict of Nantes was, or Nantes? Yes, it's been a while since we talked about that, but that was an edict that guaranteed the religious liberty of his Protestant subjects, the Huguenots, or sometimes you hear them called the Huguenots. He revoked that, and as a result, Huguenot refugees began to flood into England. And as they came telling all of these horrifying stories of Catholic intolerance in France. And there was really nothing James could do to keep these people from flooding in, to prevent English people from giving a generous welcome to these Huguenot refugees. And this hurt James badly, because the Protestant English, then they were beginning to fear that Catholic James would sooner or later treat them as Louis had treated the French Protestants. And then James made things worse. When Parliament reassembled in November of that year, James demanded huge sums of money to increase the size of his royal army, and that was partly because he was paranoid about the prospect of further rebellions rising up in the country. And he also informed the Parliament that Roman Catholic military officers he appointed would stay in command because he could not trust any others to be faithful to him. Well, that didn't sit very well. In fact, it was in violation of the Test Act of 1673. What was the Test Act? Well, the Test Act required all those wishing to hold office to swear an oath to the king and to the Protestant English Church, and also to sign a declaration denying the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation. So by this time, even the pro-James Tories are beginning to be alarmed. They worried that James might be creating a Catholic army to impose his religion in England. So when the vote went out, it didn't pass. They voted not to supply him with the large sum of money that he wanted, and as a result, James suspended Parliament. And as 1686 rolled around, he began taking more direct measures to promote Catholicism. He tried to invoke what was alleged to be a legal thing that was dispute in the English courts about what was called a dispensing power, and it was claimed this belonged to the king to exempt. He claimed this as a means of exempting Catholics from the Test Act, which is hard to do because the Test Act was actually aimed at Roman Catholics and keeping them out of the government. But anyway, he tried to make this argument that he was exempt from it in order to put them in the top positions in the army, the universities, in the royal government. He actually began to do that. Now, there are a number of political ins and outs and maneuvers that occurred, but eventually James was able to dismiss almost all the judges in the land who did not believe in the legality of the king's dispensing power. Once he got his guys on the bench, as it were, he began to pursue his policy of staffing the nation's leading institutions with Catholics. 13 Catholics were sworn in as members of the king's privy council. Anglican Tories who objected to this within the government, his administration, he couldn't just dismiss Parliament guys, but they were dismissed. He built royal Catholic chapels at Whitehall and Windsor. He set up a new Catholic printing press in Oxford. The royal printers in London and York were Catholics, and Catholic books were being printed. Anglican clergy were forbidden to preach against Catholicism. He appointed a Catholic head of the University College, Cambridge, and the list goes on. Well, he had now alienated his original Tory supporters. And the Whigs, of course, never supported him to begin with. And there was also just in the popular, among the people, there was a huge public outcry against James. And there began to be a flood of anti-Catholic pamphlets and treatises that began to be published from Protestant printing presses. And in 1667, James took a step that he thought was going to help him. It was dumb, but he decided he was going to try to divide the Protestants, okay? Divide the Protestant opposition. And so he did this by cloaking his pro-Catholic policy in a general expression of goodwill to all nonconformists. So he wants to split the Anglicans and the nonconformists. And his method was in 1687 to issue a declaration of indulgence. And this was to suspend all discriminatory laws against Protestant nonconformists. And they're supposed to say, oh, you're wonderful. But it also did the same for Roman Catholics. So he seemed to have thought that by this he could perhaps win over nonconformists to oppose the Anglicans in terms of their attitude toward him as king. Well, nonconformists, for example, some of the Baptists and Presbyterians, they did take advantage of the indulgence to worship freely, but at the same time, they were not so naive as to be duped by it or won over by it. They were deeply suspicious of it. The alliance between James and Tory Anglicanism was now at an end, and the Whigs, as had always been the case, you can imagine this act of indulgence, the Tories weren't too thrilled with it. And not only did it now give, you know, religious liberties to nonconformists, but to Roman Catholics as well. And so the Tories are now, they're totally out of his camp. They're totally opposed to him. The Whigs were already opposed to him. Concerning the Declaration of Indulgence, the leading Tory Anglican politician, a man named George Saville, he wrote a best-selling response in what was entitled A Letter to a Dissenter. Dissenters are nonconformists. So he's an Anglican politician writing a letter to nonconformists. And he famously told nonconformists, "You are therefore to be hugged now, only that you may the better be squeezed another time." Well, 20,000 copies of that letter were printed. It's been called one of the most successful leaflets. It was 6 pages. One of the most successful leaflets of the 17th century. Tories and Whigs, Anglicans and nonconformists, that would be like Presbyterians and Baptists, were now united in their opposition to James. Then in November of 1687, there was another best-selling pamphlet that undermined James' position that began to circulate throughout England. It was written by Gaspar Fagel. Now, who was he? Well, he was the chief magistrate of Holland, which was one of the provinces of the Dutch Republic. It was the most powerful province of the Dutch Republic, Holland. And he was acting on behalf of William of Orange, who at that time was the highest federal official of the Calvinistic Dutch Republic. And William's stake in what was happening in England was his marriage to James's daughter, James's Protestant daughter, Mary. And that meant if James died without a son, Mary would inherit the English throne. Well, this guy, Gaspar Fagel, he published a pamphlet that publicized the fact that William and Mary both disapproved of James' efforts to abolish the Test Act, the act that prevented Catholics from holding office, and it also hinted that they disapproved of the act of indulgence, which gave, you remember, religious tolerance to Roman Catholics, not just to nonconformists. And this pamphlet spread like wildfire. By 1688, 55,000 copies of it had been sold. And English Protestants began to look overseas to William of Orange as their great hope of deliverance. Well, in April 1688, James reissued his Declaration of Indulgence with a little teeth to it this time. This time he ordered the clergy of the Church of England to read it out from their pulpits. Of course, they knew what he was really after. It was the promotion of Roman Catholicism. So even though it was normally the instinct of Anglicans to support the crown, 7 very prominent bishops, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was the highest position in the English Church, Archbishop Sancroft of Canterbury, John Lake, William Lloyd, Thomas White, Francis Turner, Thomas Kerr, Jonathan Trelawney, all 7 of these bishops. You remember, bishop was a higher position than just a local church pastor. A bishop oversaw several churches in a region. Of course, the archbishop was over the entire Church of England. Well, all 7 of these men handed in a petition to James asking to be excused from reading the indulgence. And then several other leading Anglican clergy who were not bishops also signed the petition. Well, James was enraged by this, and he had the seven bishops arrested. And also those Anglican clergy who did read the indulgence from their pulpits were in for a big surprise when they did, because guess what happened? Their congregations walked out. Again, though it gave freedom to Protestant nonconformists, the nonconformists were not duped by it either. Even the vast majority of them opposed it. The Calvinist Baptist leader, William Kiffin, one of the authors of our confession, he advised the Baptist churches to make pragmatic use of their newfound liberty, but offer no thanks to James, since his motives were bad. And in reality, the indulgence itself, because it included Catholics, was unlawful. Richard Baxter, how did he use his freedom now granted by the king? Well, he used it to actually preach a sermon praising the seven imprisoned bishops for their heroic defense of a, what he called, papist tyrant. The trial of the seven bishops was held on June 29th, 1688. And on June 30th, boy, was James in for a surprise. Because guess what the verdict was? Not guilty. James was stunned. On the very night of the verdict, seven leaders of the opposition to James signed a letter addressed to William of Orange, pleading with him to land in England with his Dutch army and save the liberties of the Protestant people. And the letter was especially urgent because on June the 10th, a son was born to James. He now had a male heir to the throne. We'll learn a little bit about him later. Well, the terrible prospect now of a Catholic dynasty in England, it drove almost every Protestant in England into a fury of dread that was prepared, if necessary, for revolution. Now, William, he had a number of motives here. I know he had other motives in this. He wanted to destroy the ambitions of the Roman Catholic King of France, Louis XIV, to control Europe in the interest of Catholic France. He feared that there might be an alliance developed between James and Louis. And so he managed to secure the support of the Dutch ruling classes and his German allies for an invasion of England. And so on November the 1st, 1688, William's fleet set sail for England. There were 600 ships carrying 15,000 Dutch troops. And meanwhile, the rank and file of James' army started deserting him. So James brought over a contingent of Irish Catholic soldiers, which will prove to be an unreliable group of men. William's army landed at Torbay in Devon on November the 5th, and he didn't really need to do anything. He simply published a manifesto denying any intention of conquest and assuring everyone that he had come only at the invitation of England's civil and spiritual leaders. He also denounced in the manifesto James's unconstitutional acts and called for a free parliament to resolve the national grievances. Well, James ordered his unreliable army to Salisbury to prepare to fight, but already some of the prominent nobles in England had declared in favor of William. The northern counties had also been mobilized against James, and on November 24th, James's most loyal servant and most capable general, the Tory Lord John Churchill, defected from the army, together with 400 officers and men. Well, at this point, James tucked his tail and ran. That's basically what he did. He lost his nerve at that point, and he cut out. He was terrified that he might meet the fate of his father, Charles I, and be executed by his own people. So he fled, but he was captured by a Protestant mob at Faversham, carried back to Whitehall as a prisoner, but William's Dutch troops were in some measure kind to him. They set him free and allowed him to escape to France. Well, after James left England, the members of the House of Lords and the House of Commons, acting as representatives, entrusted William with the country's administration. And the what was called the Convention Parliament then, met on January 22nd, 1689, and declared that since James had abandoned his country, the English throne was now vacant. Now, Whigs and Tories were agreed on that, but at first, the Tories, remember, they still have this commitment to a monarchical government and a king. They wanted to make William kind of a temporary regent and then later to give the crown to James's newborn son. Well, William would have none of that. He didn't want that. He wouldn't accept that. If he were to govern England, he must be king. Well, finally, the Tories gave in. And on April 11th, William and Mary were crowned as joint monarchs of England. Now, they were crowned on condition. They had to accept what was called not our Bill of Rights, but a Bill of Rights that was at that time. And they did accept it. Some of the things in the bill were that it prohibited Roman Catholics from occupying the throne, declared illegal the monarch's power to suspend the operation of laws passed by the Parliament. It made parliamentary freedom of speech absolute. No MP could be prosecuted for anything that he said in Parliament. And William and Mary's acceptance of the Bill of Rights, it really put an end to any idea of absolute monarchy in England. The king would now, from that point on, rule under a constitution. And these events in England are known as the Glorious Revolution. The religious settlement that resulted of 1689, it brought an end at last to the persecution of nonconformists. They were given legal freedom to worship in what was called the Act of Toleration, which was passed in May of 1689. To obtain, though, the benefits of the act, those of Presbyterian, Independent, and Baptist persuasion had to subscribe to the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church, with exceptions, the parts that dealt with church government, and for Baptists, the article on baptism. And most of them had no problem agreeing with that. The 39 Articles themselves, the doctrinal statement, is really quite good, if you've ever read it. They didn't have a problem with that. They didn't want to conform to the Anglican form of worship, church government, view of the sacraments, and so forth, but they could accept the 39 Articles. So most had no problem agreeing to that. And at that point, nonconformists became as fully protected as Anglicans in their worship, and hundreds of new nonconformist chapels were built all over England. But it wasn't complete equality that was granted to them. They were still discriminated against for many years to come. There were still some restrictions on nonconformists. For example, they could not hold public office. They were not allowed to send their children to Oxford or to Cambridge, but they could and did sit in Parliament. And there was one restriction, I think, that was especially kind of annoying to nonconformists. They still had the legal obligation to pay tithes to the Anglican Church. Well, James II, what happened to him? You may wonder, did he just go off and stay in France? Well, no, he didn't make an attempt to recover his throne. He with 6,000 French troops that were given to him by Louis, he landed in Ireland in March of 1689, and all the Catholic Irish rallied to his support. Most Irish Protestants, of course, supported William. William joined the fray in Ireland, and he defeated James and his army at the Battle of the Boyne on July the 1st. James fled back to France, and within a year, William's forces had reconquered the whole of Ireland. By the way, the Battle of Boyne is still celebrated in Northern Ireland. If you've ever been to Northern Ireland, you also see these orange lodges everywhere. It's kind of like Masons, but they're called Orange Lodges. It goes back to William of Orange, and they celebrate the Battle of Boyne on July the 12th, or the battle was fought on July the 1st. July the 12th was the day when James's army was completely destroyed. Kelly and I were actually in Northern Ireland one time on July the 12th, and it was quite amazing, you know, because you still have tensions there between Roman Catholics and Protestants, but the Protestants are all out on the streets marching and beating drums and parades and all kinds of celebrations of the day that William of Orange defeated James at the Battle of Boyne. William and Mary were also recognized as rulers of Scotland, though they did maintain the independent rights of the Church of Scotland. The Scots ratified the Westminster Confession and declared Presbyterianism the church form recognized by the government. And so, brothers and sisters, it's the Glorious Revolution then that marks the end of what is commonly called the Puritan era in England. And we'll look at developments that happened after that, leading all the way up to the Enlightenment and into the Great Awakening. That's where we'll be heading next. But we can be thankful for this, the outcome here, because it was a large step forward in the direction of eventually what brought about the religious liberties that we enjoy. It was a big step in that direction. We can take those things for granted sometimes. And it's good for us to understand how they were debated and fought out on the battlefield, and how these happened. And we can also learn from the Puritan era about the kinds of things, I think, when we're talking about politics, that can happen when there is an attempt by the civil government to impose a particular denomination or form of Christianity upon its citizens. And these are lessons that were beginning to be learned during this period, though there are still more changes to come, especially when we cross over to the events that occurred in the 18th century in the American colonies. Another thing, point of interest here, we as a church, our confession of faith is the Second London Baptist Confession. It's also called the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith. Does anybody know why it's called that? Similar. It's related to that, yeah. They finally had the freedom to publish it. It wasn't actually even written in 1689. Does anybody know when it was written? Well, no, not 1644. There was. Who said that? 1644. Yeah, there was. There was. What? Jackie. No. Yeah, there was a confession that the particular Baptist put together in 1644, the 1644 Baptist Confession of Faith, but it's smaller, it's not as detailed, and our confession was actually written in 1677. Yes. Right, yeah, that's right. In November, we're having a module, and you'll learn all the history behind our confession and so forth. And it was written in 1677, but now that there's religious liberty, they published it. And so it's called the 1689. And they published it, remember, to show that they were largely in agreement with the Protestant churches in their theology and their doctrine. In fact, as I've commented before, most of it is taken word from word, word for word from paragraphs adopted from the Congregationalist Confession of Faith, the Savoy Declaration. And I think there's only like six original paragraphs, and the most original parts, maybe a few more than that, but the most original parts are the chapter on the doctrine of the church, which of course is going to be different from a Baptist perspective, and on the issue of baptism and our understanding of baptism. So their purpose really in publishing it was not to distance himself, but to actually help the rest of England to see that we're not, you know, weirdos, we're not Anabaptists like on the continent, Arminian and so forth, but we are in the stream of the historic Reformed theology and our understanding of the gospel and of Scripture. So that was published in 1689. Okay.
We hope you were edified by this message. For additional sermons, as well as information on giving to the ministry of Emmanuel Baptist Church and on our current building project, you can visit us online at ebcfl.org. That's ebcfl.org.